If you know your gender is different from what people assumed when you were born based on your body, a decision to inhabit an identity that feels right to you is surely a life-changing thing. But if you imagine that you'd be happy all the time after deciding on that transition, you may have set yourself up for disappointment. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Hill Melatino is assistant professor in the departments of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies and Philosophy at Penn State. He's experienced the joys of a gender transition and also the ways such a transition is really hard, even when it's absolutely the right thing for the person making the decision. Ambivalence is something we expect in most situations when we make an enormous commitment. But Melatino has noted that folks are expected to radiate a kind of gender euphoria in the wake of a gender transition, and that can be a problem. Melatino's book is called Side Effects on Being Trans and Feeling Bad. Hill, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Just so everybody's clear, this is not a book designed to demonize or even discourage trans identity. You do have concerns about this expectation some people have that transitioning will, like, result in a kind of permanent euphoria. Where does that misconception come from?
Yeah, I think that misconception comes primarily from the current and historical mainstream discourse around gender transition, and also from medical narratives that then trickle down about the promise of transition. So what I mean by that is we have this narrative that, and it's a similar narrative that has shaped coming out for gays, lesbians, and bisexuals for quite a long time, that the process of coming to a sort of truth about oneself and then admitting that publicly and taking steps to live more authentically in this identity is going to make life better on pretty much every register, but certainly emotionally. And that narrative is part of, I don't know, I feel like it's part of the cultural fabric that has shaped pride discourse. And it's just part of our popular narrative about why transitioning is really important and imperative. And I wanted to push back against that, largely because myself and most of the trans folks I'm friends with, and there are many, deal with negative affect on the regular. I mean, all human beings do, but I think it's particularly intensified for trans folks. And that has to do with the fact that where one is in relationship to transition, whether one is post-transition, pre-transition, thinking about it in the midst of it, there's still the reality of everyday forms of trans antagonism that are relentless that folks have to deal with. And whether or not one transitions and how one transitions or, you know, all of that, it doesn't actually mitigate the accreted impact of those forms of trans antagonism.
How does the pervasive climate of transphobia in our culture shape the pressure some trans folks feel to act happy all the time, to sort of project this euphoria?
Yeah, I think there's something complicated happening with that. On the one hand, it's a way of modeling a kind of joy in being trans and in this experience of gender euphoria for folks who have reservations about transitioning. So it's a way to be a sort of possibility model. That's the phrase that sometimes gets used to describe this. And I think that's great and essential, but it's also troubling insofar as when one appears in public spaces as trans and when one is sort of visibly or legibly or recognizably trans, there's this enormous emphasis to be a positive role model. And one can't always live up to that expectation. I mean, I think about this a lot because I am a very out trans intellectual, academic, professor. And when I appear publicly, when I appear in the classroom, I don't want to model a kind of cynicism or depression or negativity that's often where I'm at emotionally. So it's this idea that you have to sort of put on a happy face because we can't afford as a movement, as a community, to have sort of negative or cynical or sarcastic representations, because that would jeopardize the success of the movement. And also in the context of a public climate where there's so much demonization of transition, there's real, real emphasis on performing happiness in the face of that and insisting on the fact that transition is ultimately happy making, ultimately edifying. And I think it's just more complicated than that. I don't argue that that's not true, but I think that there's a real negative impact that comes along with this injunction to perform happiness publicly constantly if one is a public trans person.
Right. So, like, if you express any kind of ambivalence about any aspect of your life as a trans person, God forbid you're giving ammunition to people who think no one should transition.
Absolutely, exactly.
So, I wonder if there's also a risk that trans folks who recognize that they are not deliriously happy all the time worry they're somehow doing it wrong because of others around them who are performing this kind of euphoria.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the problem is so much other trans folks. I think that most, if you talk to most trans people about the experience of negativity, people are like, yeah, for sure, right? Every day. And it's actually within trans spaces where I think there's a real honest discourse about the long-lasting impacts of the set of negative affects I talk about in the book. I think that, yeah, the trouble really lies with the sort of structural and political cost of being open about that negativity. So there's this idea that if you feel ambivalent, even about a specific surgical or hormonal aspect of transition, that somehow means that transition was the wrong decision and ultimately one should detransition. I think it's easy to internalize that really trans antagonistic or transphobic rhetoric. And in the absence of having access to a broader trans community, which many trans folks, especially younger trans folks, don't necessarily have, it's easy to internalize that message and think that ambivalence or that ambiguity is actually the product of transitioning or making the decision to transition. So the more public discourse we have about the complexity of just mundane trans experiences, I think the better off we trans folks are culturally, politically, and otherwise. So the aim of my work is really to complexify narratives of trans experience beyond the sort of like celebrity tokenization that we see, and also beyond the heavy emphasis on victimization in the forms of homicide and suicide.
I don't actually know. There's a title, a pun in the title. It's really side affects. How do you choose to pronounce the name of the title of your book?
Yeah, I say side affects, even though a lot of people are just casually calling it side effects, and I keep wanting to correct folks, but that's impossible to do at some point. So thank you for asking the question.
Talk about why affects is a word that you wanted in this title.
Yeah, so there's a whole subfield of academic study that has to do with emotion and affect that I pull upon in the book. And affect is really, it's a way of talking about the kind of feelings that circulate amongst communities, amongst publics. And the way that I talk about it in the book is I'm trying to explore ways of feeling that are extremely common in trans communities, but that are under discussed in mainstream discourses about transness. So affect is an easy way of thinking about it is just like vibe. So it's a kind of the book is a vibe check of trans communal spaces.
So, one interesting challenge for many trans folks is this inevitable lag time between recognizing one's identity and actively transitioning in whatever forms feel appropriate to them. If folks require medical care to transition the way they want, there are these enormous hurdles to climb. Talk about how the healthcare system functions as a kind of self-appointed gatekeeper to gender transition.
Yeah, absolutely. So the history of medical gatekeeping in relationship to transition is very long as there has been a medical concept of gender transition, there has been a whole rigorous system of medical gatekeeping that has evaluated prospective gender transitioners in relationship to their readiness, their mental stability and mental health, and also historically at least the chances of them being passable as cisgender, so not being read as transgender publicly after surgical and hormonal transition. That's no longer, the emphasis on passability is no longer really intensively the case in the US, but the legacy of gatekeeping persists. And it's manifested in psychiatric diagnostics where one has to prove that they desire to transition from a place of sound mind and body, that they're not, that it's not a product of some other kind of ostensible mental pathology. And also there's gatekeeping in the form of economic barriers to transition. And this has to do with the kind of insurance policy one has, whether it's trans inclusive or not, and whether one can afford to pay the cost of her surgical and hormonal transition out of pocket. There are also many, many economic barriers that have to do with procedures like, for instance, electrolysis or facial feminization surgery for trans women that are rarely covered by insurance, but nevertheless really integral to processes of transition and gender affirmation.
To go back to the medical gatekeeping, aside from the money aspect of it, you mentioned like they have to, folks feel like they have to rule out mental health problems, but it's entirely possible, right, to be bipolar and trans, or have depression and be trans, or have anxiety and be trans, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think the emphasis has been on sort of rending those things apart and making sure that depression and anxiety, et cetera, is not the motor for the desire to transition, which is admittedly, right, a very difficult, perhaps impossible task for medical and psychiatric practitioners.
Are there other health procedures you can think of that require that sort of sign-off that gender transition does?
Yeah, I mean, I think my immediate impulse is to say no. And the analog that I always go to has to do with other forms of plastic surgery, where one isn't subject to a kind of, a mental health diagnostic and check-in to explain their desire for breast enhancement or breast reduction or a nose job. So we can grant that folks can modify their bodies and have the desire to modify their bodies in all sorts of ways that don't require a kind of, or that aren't shaped by this anxiety about whether the motivation for doing it is authentic and good.
Are healthcare professionals just worried about something turning around to bite them, them being blamed for participating in a transition that somebody later regrets?
I mean, I think historically that's been the case, yeah. And if you look at the medical archives of trans medicine, there is a fair amount of hand-wringing around questions of liability in relationship to potential detransition or regret. I don't think that that's the case any longer, at least not as intensively. But I do think that transition still in our culture represents a sort of special case. So we don't understand gender transition is on par with other desires for body modification or other desires to just live differently in the world, to inhabit the world differently. It's still very much tied to questions of pathology, really, and I would also say abjection. And I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that, but that's my hunch.
Hill, how does the sort of standard narrative about life divided into pre and post-transition experiences interpret that time in between, the time when one is becoming who and what one wishes to be?
I think that the emphasis on transition as this radical life-changing event produces an idea of being pre-transition and post-transition that actually really works to elide the long space of becoming trans, the long space of actually thinking about and then taking steps to undergo transition. I also have questions about when transition ever ends as well. So the idea that one is post-transition, like how many years does one have to be on hormones to be post-transition? How many different kinds of surgical procedures does one undergo to count as post-transition? So in the book, I push back against this idea that there is a definitive pre and post of transition and try to think of most trans folks as inhabiting what I talk about as an interregnum, which is really just a long space of movement from assigned gender at birth into some other manifestation of gendered embodiment. And the reason that I do that in part has to do with questions of memory. So I argue that the idea that one eventually achieves a status of being post-transition, and being post-transition also means one is in a much better place affectively, emotionally, perhaps economically, socially. doesn't really do justice to how the long history of encountering trans antagonism and just the difficulty of grappling with the reality that one is indeed trans and probably should do something about that, continues to inform one's life well after one has taken steps towards surgical and hormonal transition. So, in order to complexify the conversation about how transition feels and how trans experience is effectively nuanced, I found it necessary to push back against this idea that there's a pre-transition, there's a post-transition, and pre-transition is terrible and post-transition is wonderful. I just thought that was absolutely reductive.
What is this concept that the scholar Laura Horak calls hormone time?
Yeah, so Laura Horak's work is wonderful. I highly suggest that folks read it if they're interested in this topic. And when she writes about hormone time, she's getting at this idea. Let me take a step back for a second and note that often you will see on trans people's social media profiles a date listed as like a date of rebirth, like the day that one starts taking gender-affirming hormones. And Laura Horak's work looks at that phenomenon and then troubles it and thinks about the kind of temporal messaging that lies behind it. So it produces this idea that one's life sort of starts anew once one begins the process of hormonal transition, and that is a kind of entrance into a promised land of, trans happiness. And it really overdetermines this idea that to be authentically trans means to be on hormones, and one isn't really trans until one has begun taking gender-affirming hormones. But it also produces this really false idea of radical transformation and rebirth in that moment, when the reality of it is, hormones take a while to manifest in terms of how they shift one's embodiment, and that changes over the course of many months and years. And also, on some level, psychically, we are still the same people, regardless of what particular cocktail of hormones our body is producing, whether endogenously or what we're taking exogenously. And that's for cis people as well as trans people, right, over the course of our lifespans. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, cisgender people will be aware that, the arrival of secondary sex hormones doesn't necessarily deliver you the body you always dreamed of, right? And
Right.
you
And
write,
sometimes it's the opposite,
right?
actually.
You write here, a trans man might be thrilled by the arrival of facial hair and less excited to find, oh, I have back hair now as well.
Yeah. And that is my life story as well.
Yeah, so it's just, I mean, we all have to sort of learn to accept the bodies that come to us. How is this process complicated for trans people who decide they don't want any kind of medical intervention or who identify outside the gender binary? So hormonal treatments or surgical treatments might not make sense.
Yeah. I think that it's produced a really intense rift within trans communities that tends to circulate around whether or not one is authentically or legibly trans or trans enough if they decide not to pursue surgical or hormonal transition or do perhaps low dose hormonal transition. And I think that that doesn't really serve anybody. It doesn't serve folks who understand themselves according to a pretty strict medical model of transsexuality in relationship to gender transition. And it also doesn't really serve non-binary folks or non-hormonally transitioning folks either. So the rift produces instead a kind of reflection of the gatekeeping that has shaped medical access to transition. It's a kind of internalization of that within the infrapolitics of trans communities. And I think it's real important to just state unequivocally that one can be trans regardless of what particular kinds of surgical or hormonal transition they pursue, and if they don't pursue it at all. And I would love to see less transcommunal infighting around that.
I'm going to ask this question. I want you to understand that I'm not implying that I don't think trans people should transition, should exist, but I wonder if you think it's possible that any generation of human beings will ever dismantle gender stereotypes and expectations to the extent that the sort of binary that we have all either decided to live with or push back against will not be so obvious as to make people feel as if their option is to transition or else really be unhappy.
I mean, I think that the gender binary is not what produces the desire to transition. So I want to be very clear about that. I think that if anything, I understand transness is about proliferating possibilities for embodiment beyond the gender binary. I think that the medical regulation of transition has been deeply shaped by an insistence on a binary understanding of gender that is then yoked to a binary understanding of biological sex, which is reductive and not true. Biological sex is not binary. One of my earlier books actually deals entirely with that. So I guess what I'm suggesting is I actually think that in the US in this moment, we're living through a historical epic wherein gender is becoming no longer binary. It's widely understood to be no longer binary. And that's part of why we see such intense trans antagonistic pushback right now, at the same time as we see a loosening of the politics of access and gatekeeping around trans related surgeries and hormones, at least in certain states at the moment. So I think what I want to say is that I actually think in the US, right now, we are living through a moment wherein gender is becoming something other than binary, is understood as something other than binary. And I think that that's beautiful, and it actually makes trans lives much more possible.
What sort of relationship do trans people have to navigate to their own bodies and their own sort of presentation to the world during the period of transition before they feel like, if this is the goal to pass as their gender identity, before they feel like they can do that?
Yeah, could I ask you to reframe that a little bit?
So, in other words, I wonder, if for some trans folks, living in a body that causes people to misgender them on a regular basis has been a source of great distress. When you've decided you want to change that, what's it like before you feel like you have the body that you wish you had, but you're sort of working medically or socially to sort of get to that appearance?
So I hear you asking about the phenomenon of misrecognition, social misrecognition. I think that that's I think it's quite hard to grapple with the psychic and emotional cost of consistent gendered misrecognition. And that it means that for many trans folks, there's a strategy of like numbing out and dissociation that happens just by way of response to consistent social misrecognition of gender. And I don't know if there's any way around that or any way to avoid that. I think it's extremely common, right? Every trans person I know has had the experience of being repeatedly dead named, repeatedly mispronounced. And that often doesn't go away even after folks transition and might be understood to be passable as cis, largely because there are folks in your life that know your embodied history and that know that you're trans and have a really hard time wrapping their brain around the fact that you might use new pronouns in a different name. Just anecdotally, for instance, my younger brother, who I love dearly, will often misgender me even though I have a full beard and big muscles. So this is an extremely common phenomenon, not necessarily hinging on transition. And I think that it means that trans folks become really, really good at checking out mentally of hostile social situations.
But that has a
And that's a
cost,
survival
right?
skill. First, yeah, it's a survival skill with a deep cost. Absolutely.
What is it like? I mean, is it like you can take, five of these a day before you are just ready to, grab somebody by the throat? I mean, how do you sort of learn to manage that so that it doesn't cost you more than it costs anybody else?
I mean, I think that it's really, really key to have access to other trans folks, to trans communal spaces where that experience can be heard and witnessed and recognized and dignified. I think that that's absolutely imperative. And in my experience, that's the only thing that's made those moments or those really bad days, weeks, or months more livable or more tenable. And I can't underestimate the importance of being, witnessed in those moments, of having somebody accurately identify your outrage or your anxiety that stemmed from forms of social misrecognition. It's just crucial.
So I think what you just described, Hill, is it's helpful to have someone else in the room affirm your true identity when someone else either innocently or malevolently has misgendered you.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
How do you make the decision to correct someone, to let it slide? I mean, how much does it matter whether someone has made an innocent mistake or is trying to rile you? In some ways, that if someone is doing this deliberately, it might be dangerous to correct them.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think in an everyday sense, it's usually innocuous. Not necessarily a bad faith misgendering, at least that's been fortunately my own experience. But what's invaluable in those moments is to have other people take on the emotional burden of correcting in a very low key and non-dramatic way. I think that that is usually the best strategy. Or letting the phenomenon slide in the moment and maybe offering a gentle corrective to someone in the aftermath. So say when a meeting ends, or when a social function is breaking up. I think that individual trans folks really often bear the burden of doing this sort of work of both alerting folks to the fact that they have been misgendered, deadnamed, and then also doing the emotional labor of helping the people who have done that misgendering or deadnaming feel okay about the fact that it happened. And yeah, that's a kind of emotional work that is intense, and I think is not always, I think that trans folks are not always up to the task of doing that because of how exhausting it is.
There may be folks listening who are not familiar with this term, dead name. This is when someone uses the name that was assigned to you at birth, like your incorrect gender was assigned to you at birth. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This book made me think about the fact that a luxury that cisgender people have is the ability to not have to think all that often about their gender identity.
Yes. I mean, please say more, but
well,
absolutely.
I mean, you write in the book about, and there's a couple different forms this takes, but you write in the book about trans envy, like, and I wonder about the extent to which trans folks might envy people that just don't have to think about it, that just, you know, by virtue of good luck, ended up with the body and the identity that feels correct to them.
Yeah, I mean, just think about how much psychic space the fact of being trans takes up, both in terms of contemplating transition, thinking about how one could live after transition, but also in the context of social interactions, to constantly have to wonder about whether or not somebody is relating to you in the way that they are because they know or sense that you're trans. I mean, that's an enormous amount of mental energy that is just eaten up by virtue of existing as trans that cis folks just don't have to deal with. And I am often envious of the mental space that that might open up, right? To just have gender be a non-thing in one's everyday life, to not have to worry about it so much. But I don't want to overdetermine the extent to which cisgender people too have to think about gender constantly. I mean, it's not as if it's never an issue for cis folks, or if aspects of being gendered in particular ways are never issues. They of course are, especially for women. But it's just not, I think it doesn't happen with the same, the anxiety around it doesn't happen with the same intensity as it does for trans folks often.
Does that anxiety wane for trans folks over the course of years of living one's correct identity?
I think so, but I also think it really depends on what your social situation is and the kind of folks that you interact with daily. I think it's certainly the case if one is able to sort of intentionally construct a social world that is mostly full of trans-affirming and inclusive people. And I think it's less the case if one is not able to sort of co-construct a social world that is trans-affirming.
Another, potential for envy, Hill, is that transitioning can be harder to achieve for folks who don't have the resources to make it happen on their own timeline. They don't have trans-friendly insurance. They don't have the thousands of dollars that it might take for particular medical kinds of medical care.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is, It's a huge obstacle, I think, for the majority of trans folks, honestly, and informs really, really significant life decisions too, in terms of moving states or switching occupations or taking jobs because they offer trans inclusive healthcare. But also, yeah, many folks just can't afford the forms of transition that they want to access. And we tend as a culture to think of envy as something pejorative, to think of it as a phenomenon that one should just rid themselves of relentlessly, right? It's bad to be envious. And I propose in the book that envy is actually more adequately read, at least in some situations, is an indicator of structural injustice. So if trans folks find themselves envious of the forms of embodiment that they desire to access but do not currently have access to, that actually is an indicator of widespread lack of trans inclusion in healthcare services and not an individual pathology or an individual moral failing. So yeah, I'll stop there, but I'm happy to talk more about MBA's structural injustice.
Somebody else in the book that you talked to mentioned that a lot of trans folks don't get to live along the same timelines that cisgender people take for granted. There are these predictable milestones, I guess, that confirm gender identity for cis people that are often unavailable to trans folks.
Yeah, absolutely. Or at least a little bit scrambled temporally for trans folks. So, the cultural sort of the big cultural milestones in a life tend to be very, very cis-centric and heterocentric. So getting married, having kids, getting a college degree, getting a job. They're also class-centric, right? As I list them, I'm thinking like all of these things depend on a certain kind of class privilege as well. And for trans folks, that timetable ends up skewed. You can think of people who transition late in life who maybe already have built a family, have had children, and all of a sudden find themselves in the position of needing to learn how to navigate social worlds in a very different kind of embodiment and in a very different kind of gender, and have to reformat the relationship to the families that they already have sort of through their experience of transition. And one can't predict that. And also can't really control how that happens. So I think often folks upon transitioning, especially later in life, find themselves really feeling like they're starting life anew, or at least a very new chapter of life that our conventional understanding of aging doesn't really make much room for. And there's also the phenomenon of postponing a whole lot of the sort of conventional milestones that shape a life as one waits to access technologies of transition as well. So you may not want to have a long-term relationship, get settled down, build a family before accessing gender-affirming care. And depending on one's social and economic and geographic position, it might take years, maybe decades, to find yourself in a position to access that kind of care.
What kind of work does it take to come to terms with the life you lived either before you realized you were trans or before, the sort of understanding of what this was available? In other words, you might have had a happy childhood, but there might have been issues of your gender that never felt right. Your parents maybe still have pictures that are of someone of a different gender than you that they really treasure. Can you talk a little bit about the complications of that and of sort of finding peace with who you were and who you are and who you're becoming?
I mean, I think that there's a way that gender really overcodes or overdetermines our understanding of what a sense of self is. And one of the sort of challenges of the book is to maybe de-dramatize the way that we think about gender and the way that gender might determine a life, and actually say, and I would say, I do say, that it's the same life, right? Transness is a modifier. It's something that certainly shifts your experience, but you're the same person fundamentally, right? Gender is not the only determinant of personhood. And the idea that it is, and that when one transitions, it's this radical new beginning and nothing about life before carries over. I think that's honestly like a cis media fabrication. Like, I don't think that's a narrative of trans life that you get when you look at trans literature, trans memoir, trans nonfiction, or maybe sometimes people play with that as a trope, but But the idea that life just begins anew is, it's just fallacious, I think. And I think it's in the interest of, I don't know, of many folks, trans and non-trans, to push back against that idea and to understand that there is a kind of continuity and that gender might shift, but really gender shifts for everyone over the course of the lifespan.
For trans men, at least some trans men, there is perhaps some ambivalence about like the statement their transition makes, right? This is just about you, but other people might assume transitioning to a male identity means someone is somehow anti-woman, or can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. There's a long history of debate within feminist movements and feminist communities about trans masculinity that extends at least back to the early 90s and probably much earlier than that as well. And it has to do with this difficulty that comes up when one is feminist identifying, perhaps queer identifying, maybe has a history of understanding themselves as lesbian, and then admits that they want to live in a male gender identity, and inhabit a kind of masculinity that they hadn't before. Because there's this looming sort of elephant in the room that has to do with the fact of, well, like a worry about whether this is just internalized misogyny or, a way of just being duped by by patriarchy. And I think that that is maybe limited, that understanding of it is limited. But I also think there's something very real about, what it means to inhabit a male gender identity, to transition into a male gender identity in the context of a very still intensively patriarchal culture. And personally, I've had to ask myself really intense questions about what my desire for masculinity has to do with, right? Whether it's informed by a kind of penis envy, which I understand is like a real envy of actually like male social and political power. And that's not an easy thing to grapple with.
How can rage be a helpful emotion for trans folks existing in an overwhelmingly heteronormative culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think anger is an energy. And I think that embracing and sort of dignifying rage when one feels it, can mobilize work towards change in the service of producing more trans-affirmative worlds. But I think that that can't happen in a vacuum, and it doesn't happen at the level of the individual. It's really important that there is collective care that is collective care practices that are tied to the experience of rage. So rage can mobilize people, but rage also really can undo you and leave you in a difficult mental and emotional space. And it's important to help to have a community of folks that help you repair after experiencing rage.
Is there room yet within the trans community for people to choose to just make this transition for themselves and sort of not want to take part in broader movements looking for social justice? I mean, it's a lot to ask people, honestly, to sort of make this transition in life and then also come to kind of stand up for everyone else. Some people may have that in them and some people may not.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And I think that folks find themselves positioned very differently with respect to that. But something that I want to suggest is that regardless of how one feels about wanting to, bear this like this mantle of working towards trans social justice, by virtue of being a trans person in the world, you become a problem for societies and institutions that are fundamentally trans antagonistic. So even if you don't want to or don't understand yourself as an activist, just insisting on your right to exist in the world ends up being a kind of activism when the sociality you inhabit is fundamentally trans antagonistic.
So you talked about applying anger to build resilience. What does that look like?
I think it looks currently like, I mean, so we're talking in the aftermath of the overturn of Roe versus Wade, which I think you're talking about next hour.
Yes.
So it's very much on my mind too, and also the looming questions about what this means as far as movements for bodily autonomy, for trans, intersex, and non-binary people is also looming very large in my consciousness. And what I see right now is an outpouring of rage and grief, particularly via social media, but not only. And I think that that outpouring is amplified and witnessed and actually lays the groundwork for really serious strategical thinking about what to do in this cultural and political moment. This is again the idea that anger is actually a transformative energy, and it's the role of marginalized communities and peoples to sort of harness that and use it as the affective basis for building enduring social justice struggles and strategizing in the face of our current legal challenges.
I think a lot of people who hope to build a more just society for everyone will say, point to younger generations of people and say they are less inclined toward racism than previous generations. Lots of people would disagree with that. I think the same kinds of statements are made with regard to young people's acceptance of trans and non-binary and queer identities. What do you think about this sort of generational effect of being more or less able to be sort of open to the full humanity of trans and queer folks?
I mean, I would love to be able to say just, unreservedly, like the kids are all right. I'm not worried about it. I would love to be able to say that, but I can't say that. Because the fact is that folks who are coming of age right now are coming of age in one of the most publicly trans antagonistic climates that has ever existed in the United States. And the way that becomes internalized is unpredictable. I mean, I came of age during the 80s and 90s, and there was very little public discourse about transness that was accessible to me. And what it was, like trans people that were sensationalized and fetishized and tokenized on like Sally Jesse Raphael and the Phil Donahue show. I was not subject to a massive, fundamentally trans antagonistic conservative political environment like the one we're inhabiting right now. And that worries me, right? It worries me in terms of how that's transforming the like political consciousness of youth in the US. So I have that in mind, which is why I can't say unreservedly, it's going to be better 10 or 15 years down the line. I think there's a myth of this narrative of progress that we see in our current moment, right? Overinvesting in is a real danger, a real danger.
It's so ironic that the growing visibility of trans folks has seemingly triggered this kind of anti-trans sentiment that you describe.
But I mean, it's happened, see it over and over again. I'm thinking, I grew up in South Florida, and coming of age in the 80s, it was the immediate aftermath of Anita Bryant's anti-gay campaign that began in Miami and became national in the late 70s. And that was a direct backlash to increased gay and lesbian visibility culturally. So, I mean, it reliably happens whenever there is increased visibility for marginalized populations, there is a reliable backlash that occurs. How successful that backlash is, yet to be determined or up to some political contestation. But the backlash is at this point sort of sadly predictable.
Hill Melatino is assistant professor in the departments of Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies and Philosophy at Penn State. His book is called Side Affects: On Being Trans and Feeling Bad. Hill, thanks so much for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can like our page on Facebook. We are on Twitter at KERA Think. We hope you'll subscribe to the podcast. Where you get your podcast, you just search for KERA Think and sign up. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.